You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Desi, noun, a person of Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Nepali, or Sri Lankan origin who lives abroad.
American Desi. Well, that's what we hope to discover here.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of American Desi's. I am Arjun.
I am Prashanth.
Whoa, what? That's not Akash. What's going on? Akash, everybody, he's in Singapore right now. Show him love on that Twitterverse, Twitter sphere, whatever we call it these days. He's out in Singapore and Malaysia doing comedy shows over there with his boy Andrew. He just texted me, actually, not like 5 minutes ago. He's adjusting to life in Asia. So we still wanted to get you content, and we brought on one of our favorite guests and one of Akash's dear friends and a new friend of me who I'm quite the fan of, Prashanth. You'll remember him from our episode, Chipotle's Got It Figured Out, or something. I actually don't even remember the title of it, but it was a really fun conversation, so we wanted to bring him back. He's going to be our guest for this week, and we're going to put some content out for you guys. Prashanth, welcome to the show.
Dude, thank you guys for having me. This is awesome. I'm glad to jump on again.
We had a really fun time talking to you, and you know, Akash knew that was what was going to happen. One of the things that you said to me on that episode that was really, really hit me at that moment, and it's something I think about a lot, was you said, every problem I ever had would have been solved if I had just been vulnerable sooner. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah.
Since we spoke, you know, we did that back in May.
Was that long ago?
Okay. I don't know. We did it a while ago. It's been a while, man, because I've been out of the country since mid-July, so we definitely did it before then.
Yeah.
Do you still agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely do. I haven't had a ton of opportunity, like, just in kind of the way my life has been going the last couple months, like, I haven't had to run into it as much, meaning there isn't a ton of drama going on.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. Life is so cool for you.
When I think about the bigger problems, it's been pretty chill lately, which has been nice. But yeah, when I think about just bigger problems in the grand sphere of things, it conflicts with friends. I think I said this before. It's just, it always feels like there's either ego involved or a pressure to grandstand. And every time that happens, it just delays communication from people saying what they really, and then you always end up getting to the root of the problem, which gets fished out many months later with arguments or problems you've had with friends.
Well, let me cut you off. Like, the reason that I brought it up because I've had an experience over the last couple months working on this show, The Magicians, that I'm working on right now, where mm-hmm. I've been in a new position, you know, working with different people, you know, different personalities, different kind of ways of communicating, just different people. And, you know, they say that our work relationships can be one of the biggest stresses in our life, right? And I've been very fortunate that this experience has been really smooth, and I feel very grateful for that. But through this process, I have butt heads with some people. And in the course of one of these interactions, I then brought it to my acting teacher. and we were talking about it, and he brought up this concept that he calls jackal language, jackal like the animal. And okay. I wanted to share it with you because, and once he told me about it, once I've been kind of practicing it, I have thought about you a lot because of it. Because I was like, I wonder how Prashant has responded to this. I wonder what he thinks about this. So here's the idea, and I've said it on the podcast a couple times, so I'm going to be brief about it, but you'll get the idea.
Okay.
The idea is, if you get jackal language, is this, man, you get cut off by a car, right? You get someone cuts you off and you're driving, and immediately the impulse is, man, fuck you. What the fuck were you doing? Are you kidding? Didn't you just see me there? How could you pull over the wire? La 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 la. Anger, anger. And really what's going on underneath that is what? What's really going on underneath that is fear. Oh my God, holy shit, that you almost hit my car. I almost like, I saw my life flash before my eyes. I thought bodily harm was going to come to me. That didn't feel good. But the problem is, right, when we go to the jackal language of fuck you, really what we're employing is language of I'm right, you're wrong. So we go to this place of I say I'm right, I come at you, I'm right, and you're wrong. And as soon as that person hears I'm wrong, the other party, they immediately walls go up. They get defensive because no one likes to feel like they're attacked. They're being attacked. When you go out to somebody and say you're wrong, you're attacking them on some level. And so no one likes that for obvious reasons. So they get defensive. They start, in their defense, yelling back at you. Right. And then all that happens is you feel like, oh, I let off some emotion. I drive away. This other person, whatever gender, nationality, whatever the fuck they are, they drive off just being like, what? That was a shitty thing that happened at 8 o'clock in the morning when I'm just trying to get on my day. And they start their day off like that. Right. Now, if I was able to, let's just put myself in that experience. Right. The one that got cut off, and I was able to say, whoa, man, that really scared me. It comes from a place of what is, I agree to be true, that 95% of people are not coming from a bad intent. They are simply unaware. That person wasn't, maybe, I'm going to say, with 95% certainty, was unaware that his actions would scare me. Or her actions would scare me. And so when I'm able to place that vulnerability and come from a vulnerability, it allows that person to really hear. It allows awareness to maybe be transferred over to that person. And maybe now, maybe, I'm not saying it's definite, but maybe that person, next time they're driving, they're going to look out, and maybe when they look in their side view mirror and they look back, they maybe won't immediately go, maybe they'll be like, oh God, I got to check more just to make sure, because I scared somebody and I didn't like doing that because I'm not a bad person. And what it does is me, as the person that's scared, says, I know you're not a bad person. I'm going to treat you with that compassion. I'm going to lift you up and treat you like the adult that I want you to be. And then they act accordingly. And so that's this concept that I've seen it employed in, like, the way I've worked with directors, the way that I work with other actors. You know what I mean? That me coming from I'm right, that you're wrong, it ends up never moving anything forward.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think the other thing, it's kind of interesting you bring this up, because I think everyone listening should go check out this really awesome commencement speech by David Foster Wallace called This Is Water.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of speaks a little bit to what you're getting at, because I think as adults, you get so wrapped up in the minutiae of your life that it gets very hard to take like a high level view into somebody else's life and maybe where they're coming from. And that along with vulnerability is, you know, that entire lecture just deals with,
Can I interrupt for 1 second? And I want you to keep, you say it takes a high level approach into life. I even think that that's problematic, because we're making it as if it's not that difficult to do. It's just a different way of thinking.
Right. It is a different way of thinking, but it exercises a muscle that most people don't have to exercise when they're trapped in their heads all day.
Sure. But when we place it as like higher,
in the simplest terms, it's basically saying like giving people the benefit of the doubt, choosing to believe a specific narrative about them, or giving them an opportunity to like, it's like you can fill in the gaps of someone's day with all the negative aspects of what kind of how they're approaching you. You can go like, oh, this person is just being an asshole to me right now. They're saying all these mean things and all that stuff. But you don't for some reason, I just don't think like people in general seem to gravitate towards filling in the blanks of somebody else's lives with hardship or positivity when they're feeling something negative. I mean, it's such an age-old principle of just like, you know, kind of be kind to everyone because everyone's fighting a hard battle. So like in conjunction with vulnerability, it's like picking the narrative you want to give to other people around your life is such an important skill set. And I don't even know if it's like taught or even how it would be taught, but it's something as I've gotten older is really important. Like, okay, I'm frustrated right now. This person's also frustrated, but I can choose to fill in these gaps of knowledge that I have about their life to reinforce the way I feel. Or I could fill in the gaps in their life with something that kind of that forces me to reflect that, okay, maybe I'm actually like judging them too harshly. Maybe they should be cut a little bit of slack.
Well, you know, where this is taught. This would be taught in kindergarten. This would be taught in pre-K. This would be taught in like when we socialize, and then should be taught throughout. We're now so focused on STEM. We're now so focused on information, like plunging information to treat people like robots, that we're not teaching how to like navigate life at all. Technology is moving faster than our ability to navigate through it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I think this also gets at a point of like, I mean, this is getting to a whole can of worms regarding like the education system and how STEM falls into that, right? Like,
sure, which wasn't exactly where I wanted to take things down. So you're right. Let's maybe
nip
that because I'm also not an expert
but,
at that.
You know, yeah, me neither. But I will say that like that ability to just consider that somebody else's day might have been hard and factor that into why they're screaming at you is so important, I think. And it's really changed the way like I interpret a lot of the people around me, because when you kind of just accept that everyone's like just trying their best, and it sounds so corny to say that, but in reality it's true, it just takes the edge off of like a lot of arguments and a lot of like harsh feelings that you might have.
Well, let me take this to potentially crazy place. And this is where it really became like relevant on a bigger scale to me, because I think about this all the time, and I think about how I would love to, if I maybe it's a simplistic and naive belief, but if it is something that it's starting to form for me, the idea that if everyone was kind of on board with this understanding and could operate and could practice it, avoiding jackal language, that the world would be infinitely better. And one way I see it, I see Paris's response as a form of jackal language.
Yeah.
The airstrikes that Paris employed. But I've just laid out what I think is a fairly difficult to argue with narrative or argument about the flaws in jackal language, correct? That's what I laid out.
Yeah.
But no one is talking about that what Paris did was wrong. Nobody is talking about that our response in the States to the refugee crisis is wrong. No one's talking about the way that, well, some people are talking about this one, about to say that, like, the way we're starting to treat, like, Muslim Americans and Islam in general is wrong. Because we all get caught up in fear. We're getting caught up in fear right now. And ironically enough, that is scaring me as a person, because I'm like, we're moving towards jackal language is happening and jackal actions are happening without exploring the way that it's just going to further make shit worse. I can't more eloquently say it than that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of, here's the thing. I do think that look, the media is always just going to report on if it bleeds, it leads type headlines, stuff that just captures the immediate emotion, because people, especially mass audiences, generally react from an emotional place. But I do think, like, you know, at least my Facebook feed, for what it's worth, is there are a lot of articles and, you know, popular blogs and news op-eds that are talking about just sort of the backlash that Islam and Muslim Americans are facing in this country.
How many people were talking about that what Paris did was wrong? How many articles were really saying that? Not that many.
What do you? Oh, you mean like in
the airstrikes?
The airstrikes?
Yes.
I mean, the problem is that there's a lot of people just in even like the sort of counterintelligence and counterterrorism community that know that we can't get out of that conflict with body counts. That is kind of being said.
Without
the
body
thing
counts.
Is that, yeah, it's not going to work by just like bombing the shit out of Syria and all the sort of ISIS strongholds and stuff like that. Like they do realize it as like a hearts and minds kind of solution. But the thing is, and here's the thing, we're talking on the day that the president just gave, an address from the Oval Office regarding San Bernardino and, you know, touched on Paris and sort of our emotional response. And he did clarify that, you know, part of solving this conflict is not overreacting and reaching this sort of like xenophobic fever pitch with Islam and Muslim Americans and stuff like that. It's huge. And it's really important that he says that. And it's, you know, there's a lot of people already saying that, but obviously coming from the president, it becomes more formal and it becomes more of a decree. And
it still has meaning when he says something.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, he's the leader of the free world.
Right.
So, you know, what he says is very important. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the president is just a symbol, but even doing something symbolic or saying something symbolic matters. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we have in America always had a reactionary problem. I mean, even from just like
that's a human problem, though. That's not just, but I'm going beyond like
it is
nation
a human problem.
Standpoint,
you're right, so. And it just gets
and
exacerbated.
Let me say this:
increase.
We and I've said this on the episode before, but I believe it's so much more. We so often want to claim to be the highest species, right? And then we're so okay with reacting from our base emotional state. When isn't the biggest part of our evolvement as animals our mind and what our mind is able to do? And one of the things that our mind is it allows us to do is not have to be reactive. That is what is part of becoming in, like, that's what the Buddhists are training you in their form of enlightenment, is how to not be reactive to your, you know, animalistic behaviors. So that, I think, is something that we have to talk about, is like, yo, we need to change that. That's no longer an acceptable excuse for me.
Yeah, I mean, dude, I don't know how you go about getting that into like the American education system, especially if it comes with
you start having
spirituality. Yeah, I mean, I agree, like empathy and increasing empathy in that regard is huge. But I also think it's like this not making the enemy even, or this, you know, this religion other. I think that's the easiest way to demonize something, is just leave an ideology or a group of people in the dark so that you don't have to get to know them. You don't have to, you know, make them part of your community. I mean, they've done some really interesting studies about how, when Prop 8 was up for debate in California,
Prop 8 was
they,
gay marriage, right?
Yeah. They were trying to figure out a way to swing the more conservative votes. And what they did was they actually sent out people from, I think it might have been GLAAD, but don't quote me, but they just sent out gay activists and gay representatives to go knock on doors and actually sit down with people and actually talk to them and put like a human face on this very sort of cold just vote. And they got some pretty overwhelming results with just the people that were visited by gay people and were informed about the subject, and they sat down and had coffee and tea and they shook hands, and there was an exchange there. Like just that interaction alone changed a lot of people's minds on Prop 8, and they actually switched their vote. And not only did they switch their vote, they stayed switched even many years later. And so I think that's the biggest thing, is like,
so you're talking about exposure and context.
Yeah, because the problem is that a lot of people just don't have a lot of Muslim friends. They it's easy to demonize someone that's not integrated into your community or even representative. I mean, I think there's only like 3 million Muslim people in the United States. And so trying to have everyone have that sort of human face associated with this religion and have and know that these are just people who are in their community and they just want the same like benefits that this country offers every other American is so important. But I think that's like a lot of people are averse to that. And I think that's one of the biggest problems is that like there isn't enough community outreach and there isn't enough people like wanting to get to know Muslim Americans. And I mean, this is the same old story of the United States. I mean, this is Japanese internment. This is that even that article you told me about just like German Americans during the war. And you know, the second, like you mentioned, there's like this hyphenated America, and that's the ironic thing. The hyphen gets replaced by sexual orientation, religion, and ethnicity.
The hyphen is the, a way people of otherizing refer to, people. Exactly.
Yeah, and
right.
You know, there's a lot of studies around what that does semantically to people and how they kind of categorize people. But, you know, there's, you know, the main example is African American, right? Then there became gay Americans, and then there are Christian Americans, and now there are Muslim Americans. So it's like we don't even have like a very good set pattern for how we delineate these distinctions. It's all just whatever is the topic du jour and whatever is kind of the other that we need to have a fix for a problem of, we just make that the new hyphenated American. And so I don't know.
I'm losing
you
a little bit as to like where you're going with, because I was with you with the exposure thing. With what you're talking about,
so,
that exposure seems to be the thing that allows it. And it brought me to this idea, and this is something that I think about art a lot, right? And art as service is its way. I heard a fascinating story about Canada, and everyone here seems to hate it, but I think it's hilarious. When during the Super Bowl, if you watch the Super Bowl here in Canada, which is just as big, you know, percentage-wise as it is for the States, you can't watch American commercials because what they have on there are these promos that are made by the government that are about like medical care or like whatever they are. But they're like infomercials or public service announcements, right? But mm-hmm. But the government said, no, you guys, I know that there are 80% of the fucking people are watching this. So you guys are going to watch something that you need. It's the government being somewhat parenting, right? It's the government parenting.
Yeah.
It's society. Now, I'm advocating that the government needs to do a little bit more of that in the States. I really do. Or someone does, because mm-hmm. I know, because here's what it is. If you can expose people, look what happens. Look what happened when, you know, and this is trite. I'm acknowledging fully that it's trite. But Will and Grace and what it did for gay relations in the States probably can't be understated.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think like art definitely tries to lead culture and public perceptions in that way. Like, I 100% agree. And again, that's kind of doing the exact same thing in a lesser way of just putting a human face on something that frankly shouldn't be anybody's business. Like, it just shows gay people going about their lives having the same problems and their sort of sexual orientation not mattering to, it shouldn't matter, you know? You know, I had this thing. I remember I was submitting for some staff writing job, and we had to do like this rant about like Hillary Clinton or something like that. And basically, my whole point, and you know, this is kind of what you're getting at, is you know, we almost need a woman president to just show that no matter male or female, Republican or Democrat, you can still break campaign promises. And her being a good president has nothing to do with her being.
You can break.
I mean, what I mean is that, like, her being a female should have. She's still a politician, and she still has. She's going to break campaign promises. She's going to make mistakes. She's going to make good decisions.
She's
going to
do what everyone does, right? She's not going to be perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it's almost just like her femaleness needs to just be taken out of the equation, and we just need to see her for what she is, which is a politician. And I don't have anything against you know, Hillary Clinton as a person. I'm sure she's wonderful. But as a politician, it gets a little bit more murky because of the amount of interests that are getting pulled in either way. This is neither here nor there. All I'm saying is that, like, we need the first female president for the same reason we need the first black president, so that people stop taking his skin color into consideration and you're allowed to hold his feet to the fire and go, hey, how come Guantanamo's still open? Hold on a second. So-and-so hasn't done.
But has Obama, I mean, it's helped race relations, but I don't know if it's really done that much for race relations, let's be honest. I don't think it's done that much at all.
Well, when you say moving race relations and moving progress forward, there's a lot of different ways you can cut that, right? Like, yeah, maybe, like, right now especially, it feels like racial, you know, inequality is, like, in the forefront of a lot of minds of Americans. But him being president has also... he's somewhat served as like a racial lightning rod to really open up a dialogue surrounding
this. That's a good point. That's a really interesting point. Yes. Just the fact that he's existed allows for these conversations to happen that maybe were just under the surface 5 years ago and now are fully on the surface. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And right. I think
that's a really interesting
point. You truly get a sense of just how fervent people feel about just things like affirmative action or the police or urban housing development or welfare, or whatever. Or prison reform. I mean, he was the first U.S. president to visit a federal prison.
It's crazy.
And this happened only like months ago.
I know.
And so, yeah, when it comes to racial progress, he's not going to just, you know, he wasn't – I think anyone who believed that racism was over when he was elected was just, I mean, utterly naive. But with him being president, it starts the dialogue, which is at least putting everybody on the path to trying to heal this racial wound.
Can I tell you what's frustrating me right now? Can I tell you what I'm having a very visceral reaction at this moment? We want to talk about vulnerability. I'm just, it's something like I get incredibly, like I'm feeling incredibly passionate because I feel like that the ills that we are facing right now are not that difficult to handle.
Like what specifically?
I feel like the general sort of ills, because I can track it to just a lot of people to this thing not being able to like look outside. They're just being reactionary to so many feelings rather than like putting themselves in any sort of self-awareness or awareness of reality instead of the awareness of their narratives. And that to me is not that difficult a thing, and maybe I'm undermining how difficult it is. But I feel badly because I'm upset, man. It's been a hard few weeks in the world. What up, everybody? Welcome back. This really isn't going to feel like a welcome back because we don't have commercials or anything. But we took a break because we both had a couple things we had to take care of. And if you've forgotten in the last 12 seconds, I'm still with the lovely and talented Prashant. And I may say, I feel confident saying intelligent
Prashant. Nice.
but before the break, which again wasn't really a break for you guys, but before the break, we were talking about that it's been a hard couple weeks in the world and that there's been a lot going on. And it's interesting because it brings up something for me that we were talking about before we started. My show is ending in a week and a half. Like, we wrap. And that's we wrap the season. And there's a certain unknown. We're not guaranteed a second season. Even if we get a second season, it's not guaranteed that it's going to be the same people. Like, everything's going to change. In some ways, this experience is coming to a close. It's coming to an ending. You were talking about death before. And that seems to be in your head. And I don't know. I kind of, in some ways, I wanted to just open the space to kind of talk about it because I've been having, to be honest, a bit of an adverse reaction to this coming to an end.
Your show coming to an end?
To the season coming to an end. Yeah, I think I have. I mean, I've been blessed and, you know, part of my fortune is that I'm in a really incredible, safe learning experience while getting to do work that I believe in and work with people that I really like. Uh-huh. And I've worked long enough to know that this experience is ending and it will be different. You know, it can't be recreated. And hopefully it will be just as good, but it will be different. And so I think there is somewhat of a fuck, this is done.
And, yeah.
You know, there's, and not to trivialize, but there's a death to this, you know?
Do you generally take endings poorly?
Oh, interesting. Putting me on the therapy couch. I don't know. Not, you know, yeah, actually I do. As you say it, I don't think I like them. I do really badly when books end and like TV shows end. You know, I saw there's that Hulu commercial out there right now. It's like show hole. You've lived with these characters for 58 episodes, and then it's the end credits.
Yeah,
and you're like, what?
I think that's a thing.
It is a thing. I mean, you know, you get lost in a world, and then it's gone, right?
Yeah. I think I wonder a lot actually how much loss and or death just not even. Maybe as a personal experience or like when people are dealing with those things personally, but just as an abstract idea, how often they enter like everyone's heads. I'm so fascinated by how often the average person considers that. I don't know why. It's this weird morbid aspect of my personality, but I just don't know. I don't have any information around it. Like,
But the thing that's interesting is when you take death and make it an abstraction, right? Which is what I heard you say. Then it could be, I mean, everything has a death, right? So the ending of a book is a death. So do you count those as well, or do you mean like physical death?
No, I mean it specifically in the context of like life.
Life ending.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know why. I've just always found that, and I guess religion plays a big role in that. So even just maybe looking, since the afterlife is a huge component of religion, maybe just seeing how far religion spreads gives you a good indication of how fearful or how much one's death is on people's, you know, the average person's mind. But it's such a...
it's funny, oftentimes I feel like people that are, at least, you know, I grew up in the South, you know, I grew up in Tampa, and, you know, so much of... I grew up around a lot of Christianity. I mean, a lot of Christianity. And I was in... I've told this, and forgive me if I've told this to you. I was in an orchestra. I played violin for a long time, and I was in an orchestra.
You really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I was in an orchestra, and all the violinists, many of them were homeschooled. Like, in the first violin and the second violin section, many were homeschooled. And then all the woodwinds... strange, we're from like this performing arts school that was straight up in the hood. So you had them playing spades in between rehearsals. Like, it was a very strange like combination of people, right?
Okay.
But the homeschooled people, there was a lot of Christianity. And like, and not even like maliciously, but very often I was told I was going to hell. Just like, oh, you know you are, right? And it's almost like...
Really?
Even though like...
This come up? Like, at lunch?
Well, no, it would come up... I don't know how it would come up. I mean, I don't remember that well. I mean, this was, what, like 13, 14 years ago at this point. But it would come up. You know, because I was sitting... It was me and the one gay violinist would sit next to each other.
Okay.
And so I guess as, like, we were the outsiders that needed saving, I don't know. I really don't know how it came up, but it would come up for sure. And
they would just, like, wrap you both up in the same hellish sort of proclamation?
Well, yeah, because I didn't believe in Christ. And I think, you know, I was quite outspoken about certain things, so I think I probably, like, instigated some of these conversations, to be honest with you. Wouldn't put it past me. But the fact was, the point of... exploring, I guess, is that religion, in its effort to kind of ease our mind about death by creating an afterlife, in some ways has created even more concern about it. Like, I find that those people that are wrapped up in that sort of religious doctrine tend to be the most terrified of death.
Really? Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know how much I've experienced that, because I didn't grow up around a ton of... I mean, I grew up in a mainly white community, but... I don't know if religion was a huge component.
Where was that you grew up?
I grew up in Downers Grove, Illinois. Darien is my hometown, but it's like close to the... It's a Chicago suburb.
There you go. See, none of those things meant anything to me until you said Chicago. Yeah. Like, I don't know what you're doing. Okay, so you grew up in there, and then... and there wasn't... Well, I guess Chicago's a big enough city where it's not so Midwest-y.
Yeah, well, I guess, well, it depends on your definition of Midwest. I mean, in my head,
I guess I mean like heavily Christian.
Yeah, I would say it's predominantly Christian. Yeah, for sure. But I think it's just diverse enough in that not a ton of people are super, super religious. Because I think the degree to which you, you know, practice your religion is another thing. So, yeah, I don't remember ever really, like, Christianity being shoved in my face a ton. Well, or ever being told I would be sent to hell.
Well, let me ask you this question, because, I mean, this is, are you Hindu? Were you raised Hindu?
I was raised Hindu, yeah, I was. I was raised very Hindu, to be honest. Like, I went
What does that mean? Define
it
that.
It means, I went, as a kid, I went to temple almost weekly with my parents. And then I went to a Hindu Sunday school where they taught us a lot of Hindu scripture stuff. Like, I mean, they taught us Hinduism through a scripture vantage point. Like, we studied the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita and stuff like that. So I know...
You went, like, back to the Vedas.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So I know, like, a lot. I mean, look, I'm not, like, a scholar or anything, but I think I do have a general understanding of Hinduism as in terms of its rituals, in terms of its sort of texts, and in terms of its parables, because those are, in my head, the three sort of prongs that you learn Hinduism through.
Well, one of the big things of Hinduism is reincarnation.
Yes.
Is that a part of your belief structure at this point? Do you still... Mm-hmm. Identify Hinduism with, where are you now?
So that's an interesting question, because I think, like, from a lifestyle, I mean, look, everybody says that about Hinduism. It's a lifestyle, right? And I do agree with it, even though it sounds kind of trite, but there are things that I have taken from, like, that Hindu Sunday school I went to, and it really does still have application in my life today. But in terms of sort of God and reincarnation or karma, that kind of falls under the same sort of, I mean, I'm pretty agnostic in my adult life. So if I'm going to believe that heaven and hell is a human fabrication, then I also kind of have to throw reincarnation and karma under that.
Well, agnosticism is, I guess, define your agnosticism, because it almost sounds like what you're talking about is atheism more than agnosticism. So I'm losing you in some way.
Yeah, I think atheism is, you know, and especially kind of the stigma atheism has nowadays, and that it's like a militant no God certainty. I think agnostic kind of takes a more the jury's out and I'm not going to make a ruling, but I'm also not going to commit myself to anything that doesn't have evidence.
But you got rid of in heaven, hell. Isn't that some certainty? You're implying certainty there.
It's more of I'm not going to put my chips in heaven and hell until I have some evidence in that category. So I'm not going to really make it a part of my life.
So this is a whole belief structure centered around hedging your bets?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're just like completely fluidly moving wherever the pop, like, that's an interesting, that's,
I mean, in the purest form, I think I had to settle on that because I'm trying my best in my adult life to only make decisions on things that I have that are to the best of my ability and that have evidence and or data behind them. And for this, it's like, I guess you could say I'm atheist, but I also just don't like how militant some atheists are in their belief in that, just being so,
yeah, but
just so certain. And it's fine, and I understand where that comes from, but it's just a little too obnoxious for my liking.
Sure, but that's the inherent issue you're going to have with every single institution. As it becomes institutionalized, people become militant and, like missionary about it. Like, that's the nature of it.
Yeah.
But I guess at the end of the day, when you think about death for yourself, is it like 6 feet under the ground and that's it? One life, nothing else, nothing beyond.
Yeah, as of now, yes.
Right. So I had a really fascinating experience in India. I was in India when the tsunami happened in 2004.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, I mean, this number sounds audacious at this moment, but I believe it's correct. 300,000 people lost their life during the tsunami. Is that correct?
I don't know. That sounds very high.
That sounds a little crazy. So I'm, while you're talking to me, I'm sitting at my computer. I'm going to look up this. But, okay. Tsunami,
okay, that sounds high.
That sounds crazy. 230,000 people died. And yet it's not. 230,000 people died.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know why I never internalized that figure.
Because we're in the West and we don't give a shit.
Well, the only thing is that when I was in high school, when I first started getting into stand-up, one of the first big things I performed at was a tsunami benefit that I threw with a bunch of my friends to raise money for the tsunami.
And?
Meaning, I'm just surprised that, I knew it was a big enough deal that I devoted, 2 months of my life to just setting up this.
You organized it?
Yeah, I organized it. Yeah. And then we donated the funds for the relief effort. I mean, it wasn't a ton of money. It was maybe 10 or 15 grand, but it was I was cognizant enough of the devastation to know that it mattered, which is why I thought I would know that figure of 230,000, but
230,000 in 14 different countries. Indonesia was the hardest hit, following Sri Lanka, following India. India was Indonesia was hit. It was really bad in Indonesia, but India, and I've been to Chennai and I've been to the beach where, bodies.
Yeah, and right now they're also going another.
Chennai is just in a
natural disaster.
In shambles right now.
So what were you going to say?
But I just had this fascinating experience with the way that people. I'm going to use the word detachment, and I feel like judgment may be attached by listeners to that word. So I want to be very careful about the way that it's heard. Okay. I don't mean detachment emotionally, like no one gave a shit. I mean that there was a different perspective on life being lost that I viewed in India.
Which was what?
It seemed like people were, it was not as dramatic. Life being lost was not as dramatic a thing. And I didn't understand it at the time. It was just I was young at the time, and it was just, but I remember it was a very striking, and I always attributed it to an overwhelming belief in reincarnation and how that's just entrenched in the world there in some way. And I'm not saying that everyone's Hindu, and I'm not saying that everyone believes that there, but it's, there's a lot of Hinduism there.
I mean, yeah, it's a dominant religion for sure.
So I it was just an interesting sort of reaction. I mean, everyone went to help, and there was I don't know if I'm explaining this well.
I mean, in what way do you feel like you felt people were more? Yeah, I don't want to say indifferent, because it's not that.
It's not indifferent. It's not at all, and it's not that. It was a detached involvement. Right? They were still involved. I mean, there was still a ton of activism surrounding it. It was constantly over the news. It was constantly, it was what everyone was talking about. But it was also this acceptance that death is a part of life. I think that's what it was more about.
Interesting.
It was more about the acceptance of the circle of life more than that allowed for a different sort of reaction to it than I was accustomed to up until that point in the West.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And I feel
I can see that.
I feel like that there is this desire in the West to fight death. We're constantly trying to control death. We're constantly trying to prolong our life. We're constantly trying to, hospice care and these death panels where everyone was talked about was go, this is the devil's work. This is the devil's work. When really it's you know what? Death is going to happen. Maybe we just need to allow it to happen sometimes when we need to accept defeat to it at
times.
That's
a really interesting idea. I mean, yeah, that is true. I think there is you're right. There are a lot of ventures in the United States that are about like curing death as if it's the last frontier of disease.
Right.
In that regard. I think even Google is launching like big R&D components of Alphabet to go look into, you know, prolonging life. And
I got to ask the question. I got to ask the question, why?
I don't know. I mean, look, all this would just be speculation on our parts. I have no real understanding. No, I mean,
okay, well, I'm going to throw out this idea.
Hmm.
All fear of death is really fear of the unknown, which is why we fall into any sort of aversion. Why I'm having an adverse reaction to this show ending, which to this death of this experience, right? Let's use it this way, is because then there's an unknown and I don't know what's going to happen. And right now things are good and I don't know what's going to come after that. And that scares me because I no longer feel safe. I'm safe now. You push me out of the cave. Am I going to be safe? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where I think that's. And then through that fear, and then a natural response to fear is the desire to control. So if I have light with me, I can then control and then I feel safe again, right? So if you walk into the world and know because of whatever robots or whatever cryogenic technology we have in place that you have the rest of your life, that means infinity of years to live. There's nothing it's a way of controlling the experience so that you can feel safe. All of this is that we're, to me... All of this is misplaced desires to create safety for self.
Okay.
And it's interesting because I've been reading this book called The Wisdom of Insecurity by Alan Watts. And it's all about, it's a message for an age of anxiety. And I mean, I'm just going to read a quote from the back that's like a kind of, I was looking for a summary of it, the book proposes a complete reversal of all ordinary thinking about the present state of man. The critical condition of the world compels us to face the problem. How is a man to live in a world in which he can never be secure, deprived as many are of the consolations of religious belief? The author shows that this problem contains its own solution, that the highest happiness, the supreme spiritual insight and certitude are found only in our awareness that impermanence and insecurity are inescapable and inseparable from life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and much of our machinations are not about that. They're about finding security. They're about finding an edge. They're about finding control.
So are you surmising that like the West puts less of an emphasis on like having people accept that impermanence is a part of life?
Yes, entirely. But we really should stop because bring you back. Or guys, if you want to chime in on this idea, you know what to do. Hit us up on the Twitter, hit us up on the Facebook or the Gmail or the website. I want to really thank Prashanth, you for coming on and spending this time with us. And for those guys that stuck through to the end, you know, we had a different, you know, Akash is gone and I was doing this solo and I just kind of wanted to try a different sort of thing and experiment a little bit and have some fun. So we put together a different kind of episode for you guys today. So if you're still listening, which I hope you are, let us know what you think. You know, show love to Prashanth for sharing all of his vulnerability. And and we'll catch you guys in a couple of days. I'm Arjun.
Prashanth, thank you guys for having me.
All right, guys. Catch you later.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.